Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin by talking about how eating a Mediterranean diet will benefit your brain, from Swinburne University in Australia. And then from the University of Wisconsin, we're going to get the latest on the healthiest eaters are the most culturally fit. What exactly does that mean? I'll explain. And how a greater emphasis upon nuts to replace animal proteins reduces inflammation. Who says? Well, I'll tell you about that and what it means, how we can reduce our risk of heart disease and turn off pain throughout the body, which we need to do. And then we're also going to look at the latest research from the University of Texas on how sandalwood, many of you are familiar with sandalwood, can help breast cancer patients. And also we're going to explore today the anti-inflammatory diet lowers your risk of depression by 26%. Who says? University of South Carolina, a 12-year study, 6,438 middle-aged women. So it's a good study. Could you imagine if we were able to help 26% of all women with just something as simple as getting rid of the pro-inflammatory foods and beverages, replacing them with ones which heal the cells, and more? Also, from our environmental segment today, something that I have spoken about, many of you who listen to this program on a regular basis understand that I've been working on a major book for about 8 years. It should be finished in the next year, and a major documentary. It'll be a series because I'm taking on all the tipping points, meaning those elements within our environment, like the circulating belt that takes warm water from the south and takes it north up around England and Ireland, Scotland, towards Greenland, then brings it back down again. That's a conveyor belt. If that stops, you're going to have a devastation of the entire European continent. And it's almost stopping. So I'll tell you about that. It takes a long time to study these phenomena, to go to those locations, to be able to walk on, let's say, black dirt, which is really just decomposed moss, peat moss. And when you walk, it's like walking on a waterbed. Your body goes down with every step. That's not good, because that means that methane gas is coming up, and methane gas contributes to global warming. And that means that we're going to get hotter days than what we have, less rain in most places, more rain than where we don't need it. And in fact, now they're actually calling it rain bombs. So much rain falls at one time that people die. 22 people died just this weekend, just a matter of hours, in one rain bomb storm. No longer the kind of thing you can walk out with an umbrella. You know, it'll wash away cars, drowns people. So now there's a new study from the National Center for Atmospheric and Research University, and it says the following. Climate change already accelerating sea level rise, study finds. Do you remember some time ago, probably 3 years ago, I did a one-week special every day on the impact of global warming and the fact that we don't have 100 years. It's happening right now. You're going to see the total destruction of Bangladesh in the very near future. You're going to see Bangkok no longer be able to be a habitat for people within the next 5 years. We're losing to the sea. So it's happening now. I warned about this, and I'll get into it a little more. I'm also today going to give you an idea that everything our government and president and everyone else has said about our economy is simply not true. So what is the truth? I will give you the actual figures that could be and they're their figures to show you what the average person is not being told they're not bringing together all of our debt into one aggregate amount and then comparing that to our gross domestic product. I will. And I'll tell you, I'll bet no one's aware of one debt that we have in America that's $8 trillion. But I'll give you all the debt that we have, show you we're completely bankrupt, totally bankrupt. Well, if you're completely, totally bankrupt and you're living on debt, how in the world can you say that we're doing fine? We're not. So let's get real, and we will on today's show. Also, the complete second half of the program, I'm going to devote to something I discussed last evening. We had a large audience last evening, according to the numbers, when I spent the entire hour interviewing a truly honest whistleblower from our government. He was Colin Powell's staff director. He was the top person with Colin Powell for years, until after it was found that the CIA and the Bush and Cheney people lied to Colin Powell about the need for the war in Iraq. And so he left. He's a professor now. And at the end of the program, we were talking about stucknecks. That's S-T-U-X-N-E-T. Stucknecks is something everyone in this audience should know. Because why we should be concerned? Who's behind it? How it can impact every person listening right now? You should know this, because you're not going to read about it in the New York Times, and you're not going to hear about it. So I'm going to give you a real tutorial today, at least a half hour on it, from several different sources. And who's behind this? The United States, the National Security Agency, the Defense Department, the CIA, and Israel's Mossad. Boy, did they make a mistake. Wow. Because they figured no one would catch them and no one could understand who did this and what the consequences were. Well, there are some very bright people out there, and they uncovered this, and they explained it, and you'll see why. The next war, forget nuclear. People are not that stupid. They have too much invested to lose it all in a nuclear confrontation. Land-based wars, yeah, you'll have some of those. But the real war is going to be cyber war, and it will be more devastating than any of the other wars. I'll explain that on today's show. Let's begin. If you've been to the Mediterranean, you know how wonderful the people and the environment is. Just so gracious and open. No matter where I go, in Spain, Portugal, France, Italy, any of the countries bordering the Mediterranean, the Western Mediterranean, you'll find them gracious and open, always friendly. Total strangers I am to them, and yet I'd be invited in to have a meal with them. And so I've always appreciated going back there whenever I can. I always like to find out their health and how well they're doing and what they attribute their long lives to. And the first thing you notice in everywhere in the Mediterranean is that they don't rush a meal. They don't like fast foods. They like slow foods. They also like slow living. They like to sit back and listen to music, and they're not impatient. Once when I was in San Sebastian, Spain, which is a magnificent ancient port, and I'm down by the water, it's night, I'm at a little tiny restaurant. I tell the gentleman I'm a vegan. He said, not a problem. And he said, you here for the World Games? I said, yes. He said, when do you race? I said, tomorrow. He said, well, I got to get you some garlic. And I said, okay. And he made some sautéed vegetables and made some absolutely outrageous potato dish for me. And he made a wonderful big salad. So it was a full meal, but it was a delicious meal. But during this meal, there were people playing classical guitars. And so I just sat there for 2 hours, just listening to classical guitar. But everybody takes their time. There's no rushing. And hence, it's a time of de-stressing, to enjoy your family and your loved ones, to sit in a beautiful environment, and to enjoy a good meal. That's a big part of the Mediterranean program. It's not just the food that they eat. It's how much love they have for one another, how much time they spend with each other, where that quality time with the one you love is a priority. It's not a convenience. In the United States, I was recently counseling a couple, mainly the husband, who has a very serious illness, and he's very wealthy, a billionaire. And I don't judge people that I counsel how they make their money. They're there to get help, and my obligation is to try to help them. If in the process of helping someone, they have been given a gift, because I don't charge them anything, I do it for free, and this audience knows that. You have a gift, you give a gift. My hope is that they then learn a lesson about humanity, and then they give some gifts in their life. Maybe go back and look at their employees and say, can I give them a better wage? Can I make their working conditions more humane? Can I change the workplace? These are things that are within someone's control. And so I sometimes remind people, if you feel that you've benefited and you want to pass the gift on, help people improve the quality of their lives. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they think I'm just a fool and naive. Well, they got something for nothing. That's all right. But I asked this woman, I said, with your husband's condition, if you had an opportunity today to do it all over, starting from when you first met, would you want more things? You have a private yacht, you have a private jet, you have homes all over the world, and jewelry and everything else. But you couldn't have both. You could have more quality time to spend with each other, sharing your love, or more things. And she said, I don't know, I'd have to think about that. Well, that taught me everything I need to know about that relationship. Boy, when you don't value the people in your life and make them a priority, then that's not a relationship that's going to work. And as a result, your health frequently suffers in the process. So understand, when we're talking about the Mediterranean, the emphasis is always on the diet. Yes, the diet's important, but a person's state of mind that's consuming that diet is equally important. The levels of stress and how you deal with stress is also important. Having people that you can speak with who care about you, who are part of your support system, that's important. Not rushing, trying to do everything on artificial schedules, that's important as well. This is from Swinburne University in Australia. Eating a Mediterranean diet can slow down cognitive decline. And this was published in the Open Access Journal Frontiers in Nutrition. And what they found was that you're much more likely to have a healthy brain if you adhere to the Mediterranean diet, which also means the Mediterranean lifestyle. That means you're going to reduce the conversion to Alzheimer's. You're going to improve in cognitive function and memory and clarity. So what we're talking about at the dietary level, we're talking about a plant-based diet, lots of green vegetables. In fact, in the United States, you see purslane all over the place. No one ever eats it. But there, all this wonderful, crunchy, slightly lemony quality, and it comes in little round, about the size of a dime, leaves. And these are thick leaves. And they're in a cold, you chill them down, put them in a salad, they're cold and delicious. They eat these all the time. They eat a lot of wild greens and dandelion greens, which are very rich in polyphenols nutrients that our body needs. They have lots of fresh fruits. In fact, in most of the families' homes that I visited, especially in the country, every meal was finished with a piece of fruit. And then when I was in Rome, I stayed in a nunnery, in a convent, and it was fun. It was interesting. If you've never, spent an evening there, you have a family-style dinner, and it's good, healthy food, and And but it always finishes with a piece of fruit. So I was asking the sister, do you ever have cake, pie, ice cream? She said, well, you can have that, but not as a part of a meal. Those are things people will get for themselves as a snack. But we prefer to always have fruit. And so we end our meals with fruit. And all day long, they're drinking spring water. Gazillion gallons of mineral waters all over Italy and France. We don't do that in the United States. And we should. And because it's good for us. But also the cereal grains that they have are whole grains. And the vegetables are plentiful. Seeds all the time and nuts everywhere. It's very common to see dishes of nuts, a variety of raw nuts, in people's homes. We would have candy and jelly beans. And they have lots of legumes. And they make wonderful dishes with different sauces with the legumes. And so that's what a Mediterranean diet is. Lots of olive oil and tons of olives. And then, of course, the wonderful environment of being around people you care about and celebrating life over a wonderful meal. So that can help you save your brain. Now, according to the University of Wisconsin, published in Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin, how to be healthy as an eater depends upon your culture. And that's what a recent study in the United States and Japan, those who were fittest, healthiest, it was because they look for things in their culture that allowed them to be healthy and fit. Quote, our results suggest that if you want to help people eat healthier, or if you want people to promote any type of healthy behavior, you want to understand what meaning that behavior has in that culture and what motivates people to be healthy culture. Now, that's important because they're giving us a big heads up there. Now, what does that mean? Well, let's just give an example. I'm coming from a culture in West Virginia. It's Appalachian, it's hillbilly, and it's what we call hollow people. People live up in the hollows, the ravines, places that are almost inhospitable, and they thrive and survive there. They each have their own dialect. They have their own way of looking at you and communicating, and they have their own type of foods, and some are healthy and some are not. But once you look at a culture and you say, within this culture, where is the high end? Where is the low end? Where's the healthy end? Where's the sick end? For example, in my home, meat was the center of every meal. And the breakfast was eggs, generally two eggs, with that people had. I would have oatmeal with nuts and raw honey in it and cream, because back then, we were with a farm, McDonald's farm, and we would get the fresh cream, and or you could get it delivered to your home. You go out in the morning, there'd be a little box. You open the box, there'd be fresh milk, and the cream be up on top because they didn't homogenize it. And it was fun. It was fun milking cows and then being in the back of a pickup truck and driving them into the local co-op dairy. You learn about people. Remember once going into an old general store, the oldest one in the entire area of the state, and this was built back in the 1800s, big old planks, and in the middle of that room, there was an old potbelly fireplace, and around that was a bunch of old men. Now, I was a kid. I was probably around 7 years, 8 years old, and my dad was with me. We just delivered some milk, and we went in there, and I'm looking at these men. And they're just sitting around there whittling wood. You know, they just keep shaving the wood with all they're all around their feet where all this wood pieces. And I walked outside and said, well, gee whiz, Dad, you know, they don't talk much. He's all son. He said, they were doing a lot of talking, just not in the way we do. It's how they looked at you. It's the body motions. They have their own way of communicating. And these are the quiet ones. And the older they get, the more quiet they are, but they're talking, they're communicating. And I didn't understand that at the time, but we have to appreciate not everyone communicates in the same way. It doesn't mean they're trying or succeeding in communicating, but they're doing it. So you got to understand a culture. But what we would allow, we would allow fruit. And in the summertime, it was a big deal to have a victory garden. A V garden was, after World War II, our parents would start a garden in their backyard because there was food rationing during the Second World War. And you'd have food coupons. You'd be able to get a coupon, and then that coupon would allow you to buy a certain amount of food. It was a rationing card. And same way with gasoline. So if you were deprived of a lot of things during the war, which they were, then after the war, everybody had a victory garden. And I remember as a little boy, you know, in the 1950s, going up and down our block where we lived, a simple, you know, block, regular, you know, working class people, and every backyard was loaded with fruits and vegetables. And they frequently canned those. So I got to see how you can stuff. Of course, they canned it with a lot of sugar, which was not good. And then you learned how to can it so it's safe. And everybody had put up preserves. They call them, we put up preserves. So they would have tomatoes. That was a big one. And krauts, sauerkraut, that was a big one. And so during the wintertime, when those were not available locally, and you couldn't get anything, there were no greenhouses growing anything, and whatever you got had to come from California, and it was always just iceberg lettuce and tasteless tomatoes. I mean, there was just nothing in the way of vegetables when I grew up. Whatever vegetables were canned vegetables, and if you could imagine the amount of sodium in there. So trying to be healthy in a culture that has no concept of a plant-based or vegan or vegetarian diet, where meat is not just revered, it's almost worshipped. You have to have the meat in order to have protein. And we didn't. So that's why so few people that I grew up with ever ate anything that was healthy, even when they weren't there, even when they'd come to New York to visit. They didn't want to go to a vegetarian restaurant. They wanted to go to the best I could do is get them to go to a Chinese restaurant. You know, and of course, that's not always healthy either because of MSG. But they needed that. They needed the chicken, you know, but they wanted the beef, but they preferred the chicken. But in other cultures such as Japan, healthy food is absolutely a part of their culture. The fermented foods, the miso, the nanos, the soy, that's normal. And the root vegetables, burdock root, normal. The miso soup. The mushroom dishes, dozens of different types of mushrooms, normal. So it's a lot easier being healthy in a culture where health is promoted, meditation is promoted, physical culture is promoted, not being overweight is promoted. And we just don't have that in America. And that's why so many Americans are overweight and unhealthy and sick and dying. And so many other people in other cultures, including Japan, it's easier for them to be healthy because their culture allows for health. Ours doesn't. There's only about 4% of the American population who are vegetarian and only 1.5% who are vegan. After all these decades and all the books and articles and documentaries, so it's not that we lack information, it's we lack will. And partly it's because of the enculturation. So that's one more way of understanding why we're so unhealthy. What we have to do, in effect, and this is bad, we have to have a whole lot of mothers and fathers really be patient and say no to the unhealthy foods and start a whole new cultural revolution of eating and exercise and going to bed at the right time and turning off the computer and cell phone and letting children outside, let them play in the dirt, let them have natural exposures, let them have measles and mumps and chicken pox and be immune for life, build up their immune system naturally, get them to breastfeed as babies for at least a year, year and a half, and that's how you start a new culture. So that from the time they're born on, they're exposed to things within their immediate environment. And then hopefully they'll have friends who also share these so that their peers will also be into health. There's a good study on the role of nuts. Now go back to Roman times where people lived longer than we do today on average, and they were much healthier. The Romans considered many nuts food of the gods, according to PreventDisease.com. And a few decades ago, nuts were valued for their protein and their vitamins and their minerals, and most importantly, their important healthy fats. Then something stupid happened. In the 1980s, we looked at nuts as these fat and calorie, foods, and we didn't want them in our body. So we went on this fat-free craze. That was wrong, because part of your health is having healthy fats. Part of your heart health is having healthy fats. Part of defending your immune system is having healthy fats like coconut oil. So anyhow, we stopped eating meats, and then we went back to animal proteins. Well, animal proteins increase inflammation, and this study showed that nuts reduce inflammation and therefore help reduce cardiovascular disorders. And this has gone on now. There are over 100 studies in the peer-reviewed literature that shows that eating nuts daily has been linked to a lower cause mortality of all causes, meaning it doesn't matter what you would die from, you're going to live longer before you die because you had nuts every day. And that's important. Walnuts, almonds, pistachio, pine nuts, macadamia, Brazil nuts, filberts, they're all good. And it's been shown that you can even impact tumor necrosis factor receptor 2, one of the biomarkers being tracked by the body, on inflammation. So have some handful of nuts every day and reduce your C-reactive protein, reduce your inflammation, and live a longer life. And the studies are there to support it. Just one study alone had 121,700 nurses, and there was also 51,529 doctors, and they studied them for over 20 years, and that's what they found. And finally, sandalwood has DNA-destroying abilities against breast cancer. University of Texas, quote, sandalwood has long been known for its cancer-healing effects, especially when it comes to breast cancer. But the exact means through which this potent essential oil affects cancer cells has remained a mystery until now. Research published just a few months ago points to how sandalwood heals breast cancer cells at the deepest level. University of Texas researchers discovered why sandalwood can help breast cancer patients. The findings of this groundbreaking University of Texas study was published in the current edition of the Journal of the Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine. It was a joint effort between the Ponce Health Science University School of Medicine in Puerto Rico and the University of Texas San Antonio. So what they found was that santanol, one of the main components of the hardwood genus santalum, or sandalwood, impacted at a very strong anti-inflammatory and level of the cells. So now they figured out how sandalwood helps people with breast cancer. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment, and we will give you a lot more information. Everyone, I'm Gary Noll. This is from our environmental segment. It's from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. It says, quote, greenhouse gases are already having an accelerating effect on sea level rise, but the impact has so far been masked by the cataclysmic 1991 eruption of a volcano in the Philippines, according to a new study in the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Satellite observations, which began in 1993, indicate that the rate of sea level rise has held fairly steady at about 3 millimeters per year, but the expected acceleration due to climate change is likely hidden in the satellite record because of a happenstance of timing. The record began soon after the eruption of this volcano, which temporarily cooled the planet, causing sea levels to drop. The new study finds that the lower starting point effectively distorts the calculation of sea level rise acceleration for the last couple of decades. The study lends support to the climate model projections, which show the rate of sea level rise escalating, all right, over time as the climate warms. And so that's important. So what's happening is this. In the last 12 months, we have seen the biggest typhoon in history. We've seen rain coming down so hard that they've reclassified the storm as a rain bomb, something new in the vernacular, that kills people, drowns them. We have seen the hottest days in history, a recorded history of our planet, for human existence, including a day of 167 degrees. Could you imagine that? And we're seeing drought at an absolutely terrible level, including what we're now saying is the 900-year drought in the Middle East, and it's only going to get worse. There's virtually no sustainable culture in the Middle East, none, and most of Africa. So if we know that this is going to get only worse, shouldn't we be responsible enough to start moving people back from the sea so that they're not adversely affected? There is still time to do this. If we had a Marshall Plan to start relocating populations inland and away from the rising tides. So it's not just storms coming in that are going to be worse than ever. We're going to see our first Category 6 hurricane in the very near future, probably the next 12 to 24 months. We'll have a Category 6. And we're going to have some major tornadoes. We saw the largest tornado in recorded history this year that was over 2 miles wide. So you don't see things like this. So these are not anomalies. This is the new norm. So I'm suggesting that we start a plan of looking at where we're most vulnerable and start a process of moving back out of harm's way. I don't believe people will do that. And if they don't, they're going to be virtually wiped out. Their homes will be wiped out. And all those homes on the East Coast, from Key West right up all of Florida, all those on the water, they're all going to be gone. Because what is a building? What is a big co-op? What is it resting on? Sand. And how did the building get held up? By concrete pylons down in the ground. And what are those resting on? They're resting on sand. So there's nothing supporting those. Nothing at all. So as a result, as the water comes in further at night with a high tide, it is now going into the ground and undermining the integrity of those support systems. First, you're going to see cracks in the building. But how are they supposed to repair it? They can't dig out all the sand and dirt around those support systems. So nothing they do is going to prevent the tides from coming in. In fact, just in Miami Beach now, they're bringing in barges of sand that they can't find anymore. Nearby, they have to go down to Puerto Rico and other places to get the sand, bring in barges, and then put it in bulldozers. And I know this for a fact because living for 15 years in South Beach, right on the water, I sold my place when I saw seaweed in the bottom coming up so far at night that it was the bottom of the swimming pool buildings on the beach. Now, in a 10-year period, that's over a 100-yard increase. That means that now it's accelerating, that that it's going to virtually destroy the value of all that property. So you're going to have hundreds of billions of dollars in lost property, the inconvenience of people having to move, but that's inevitable. So I'm simply giving you a heads up. Move to a better place. Now, talking about not being given the facts, we haven't been given the truth about how severe global warming is, because if we did, we would demand something be done about it, and the people who are causing global warming are not going to change that. The meat industry is not going to change. The big polluting industry, coal, is not going to change. And that means we have been lied to. But how bad is the economy? Here are the actual numbers. The U.S. national debt is $19.4 trillion. The state debt is $1.2 trillion. Corporate debt, $26 trillion. Car loan debt, $1 trillion. Student debt, $1.3 trillion. Credit card debt, $971 billion. Home mortgage debt, $14 trillion. Unfunded liabilities, $103 trillion. Unfunded pensions. Now, I didn't know that we had unfunded pensions, but now there's a major article. In fact, it was in Zero Hedge today by Tyler Durham's, quote, the unsolvable math problem. Public pensions are underfunded by as much as $8 trillion. Quote, defined benefit pension plans are in many cases a Ponzi scheme. Current assets are used to pay current claims in full in spite of insufficient funding to pay future liabilities. Classic Ponzi scheme. But unlike Wall Street and corporate Ponzi schemes, no one goes to jail here because the establishment is complicit. Everyone from government officials to union bosses are incentivized to maintain the status quo. Public employees get to sleep better at night thinking they have a retirement plan. Public legislators get to be reelected by union membership while pretending their states are solvent, and union bosses get to keep their jobs while hiding the truth from employees. We even published a note several days ago entitled Establishment Tries to Suppress Dissident Actuaries, Exclusive Report on Public Pensions, which pointed out that the American Academy of Actuaries and the Society of Actuaries killed a report that would have warned about the implications of lowering long-term expected returns on pension assets. Apparently, the truth was just too scary. And then it goes on to talk about how they're trying to cover this up. It goes into specifics about the Ingram's Illinois teacher's retirement system is only 41.5% funded and currently assumes annual returns of 7.5%. And so they looked at all these, and all these, if you work for these unions, you better take a very careful look and read this article, which we post on progressiveradionetwork.com, because the probability is your pension is going to run out of money. And those who are not going to retire for a while, you're looking at $8 trillion that the pensions don't have and they're not going to get. And so it's a Ponzi scheme. So what's this all add up to? Right now, the current gross domestic product is at $18.4 trillion. And the total debt, how much do we owe? $175 trillion. So we owe $175 trillion. We have $18.4 trillion coming in. That means that we have a 900% debt to gross domestic product. We are completely, totally bankrupt. And that is the truth of it. And I'm using figures. So the truth and demanding that this be addressed, because we don't have anything backing the dollar. It's just a fiat currency. Now, the Russians have the ruble backed by gold, and the Chinese had the yuan, the renminbi, backed by gold. So in the end, in a year or two or three from now, when the dollar is getting crushed, watch the value of your dollar go down diddly squat. And the people that we thought we were smarter than, they'll be fine. You can't unload 900% debt. Not today. Not anyway. So we should stop thinking that somehow creating debt is a good thing. It is not. I'm Gary Knoll. What we're going to do now, we're going to go to an audio clip. I'm not going to play the whole clip. I'm going to play segments of three clips. And I'm going to start with the shortest one. It's only 3 minutes long. It's called It's from The Hungry Beast. This deals specifically with Stutniks. You don't know what it is? You will. And Stutniks is the new reality. Why? Because we were caught. And because we were caught, now the other countries, including specifically Iran, Russia, and China, have got far more scientists than we do, and they've committed a whole national campaign to finding out how we did this and then create something in return that could turn off all the electricity in America, in every city, in every home, in every business, satellites, nuclear power plants, everything. Think about that for a moment. This is not science fiction. This is an absolutely current, as we speak, reality. Listen in, please.
Stuxnet was discovered lurking in the data banks of power plants, traffic control systems, and factories around the world. 20 times more complex than any previous virus code, it had an array of capabilities. Among them, the ability to turn up the pressure inside nuclear reactors or switch off oil pipelines, and Stuxnet could tell the system operators everything was normal. Unlike most viruses, Stuxnet doesn't carry the usual forged security clearance that helps viruses burrow into systems. It actually had a real clearance, stolen from one of the most reputable computer technology companies in the world. It exploited security gaps that system creators are unaware of. These holes are known as zero days, and the most successful viruses exploit them. The details of a zero day can be sold on the black market for $100,000. Stuxnet took advantage of 20 zero days. But once it got into a system, it didn't always activate. Buried deep in the Stuxnet code was a specific target. Without that target, the virus remained dormant. What was it looking to shut down? The centrifuges that spin nuclear material at Iran's enrichment facilities. Stuxnet was a weapon. The first to be made entirely out of code. The Washington-based Institute for Science and International Security says the virus may have shut down 1,000 centrifuges at Natanz, Iran's main enrichment facility, last year. In November, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN's nuclear watchdog, said Iran had suspended work at its nuclear facilities without explaining why. Many observers credited Stuxnet. Last month, the Iranian government conceded the virus's infection of the Bashir nuclear facility, still under construction, meant that switching the plant on could lead to a national electricity blackout. Iran has responded to the attack with an open call for hackers to join the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and has reportedly amassed the second largest online army in the world. So who was behind Stuxnet? There's no evidence beyond rumor. Some have it that Israel is responsible because the virus code apparently contains references to the Hebrew Bible. Others believe the US was involved in the testing and development. The finger has even been pointed at Siemens Mobile Phone Company, whose software is used by the Iranian regime. The most important question may not be who designed it, but who will redesign it. The evolution has been so fast that 9 months after its detection, the first virus that could crash power grids or destroy oil pipelines is available online for anyone to download and tinker with. You can watch people on YouTube pulling Stuxnet apart. It's an open source weapon. And there's no way of knowing who will use it or what they will use it for.
Now, that's just one. That's a short one. We're going to go further in depth on this because every single computer, cell phone, electrical appliance, everything that is electronic in America would not only be crashed, but then they could also make it so you could not reboot it. We could not restart anything. And we would have to replace an entire system. That would take months to do per area. And we do not have the resources to do that. That means that within 5 to 30 days, every nuclear power plant, of which we have 98 currently active, would go Fukushima. That means that we would have at least 150 million Americans exposed to radiation at lethal doses with no capacity to go anywhere, because everywhere you go, there you'd be going into another nuclear area. This would also be particularly strong in the Chicago area, the New York area, and all down the East Coast of the United States. That's what you're dealing with. Now imagine all the people in hospitals. Imagine what you would do if this were done in a very hot time where there'd be no air conditioners, no elevators. There'd be nothing that would run electronically would work. There'd be no airplanes flying. There'd be no trains driving because all those... And how would we get around if all the stoplights were off? Think of the consequences. This is the way the wars of the future will be fought. Now let's hear another audio clip from a different film altogether on the same topic.
Deep in the heart of central Iran, the Natanz Uranium Enrichment Facility is buried more than 70 feet below the desert, surrounded by thick concrete walls and guarded with anti-aircraft guns. The Iranians maintained it was to produce fuel for civilian nuclear power, but the U.S. and its allies feared its real purpose was the development of nuclear weapons. The West has long viewed the prospect of a nuclear Iran as a threat to be reckoned with.
This issue has been a source of tension between the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran.
And then, one day in 2009, without a bomb being dropped or troops on the ground, the plant in Iran was dealt a blow. A silent agent carried out a seemingly impossible act of sabotage at the Natanz facility. Slipping past the armed guards, it shattered equipment crucial to Iran's controversial nuclear program.
160 centrifuges just breaking apart, metal shards flying everywhere. You literally have shrapnel coming across the room.
The agent of destruction? A computer virus, codename Stuxnet. And it turned out to be the largest act of cyber sabotage in world history.
If you were in that room, you would literally die. You would not want to be in that room when this happened.
Eric Chen is a computer virus expert who's been analyzing cyber threats for the last 15 years. He's one of the few people on the planet qualified to discern what actually happened.
How big a deal is Stuxnet?
I don't think there's ever been anything bigger. You know, the closest thing that's been bigger is maybe the advent of the internet.
Chen works for Symantec in Los Angeles. It's one of the largest information security providers in the world. While its clients include multinational corporations, there's a good chance its software is installed on your computer at home, too. Last year, Symantec identified millions of cyber threats, but Stuxnet by far was the biggest. The company's team was instrumental in cracking Stuxnet, and what they learned will change the way countries approach warfare in the future.
Stuxnet has basically demonstrated to the world that it's possible to take computer code and cause physical real-world damage.
Stuxnet crossed over from the virtual world to the real one. The operation was so sophisticated, Chen and his team estimated it took more than 20 high-level programmers with inside knowledge of the plant at Natanz.
This is not two hackers in a basement in Kansas somewhere. When we know from the code and the sophistication and the amount of effort that needed to go into it, it had to have the resources at the level of a nation state.
And in fact, the New York Times reported in January that Stuxnet was likely a joint project between the Americans and the Israelis. It's not a particularly shocking conclusion, considering that Israel has made little secret of its willingness to attack Iranian nuclear facilities by conventional military means. Stuxnet may have given them the opportunity they've been waiting for, without having to even fire a shot. But if it was them, they're not talking. The Israeli government did not respond to our request for comment on who created Stuxnet. We didn't have much more luck with the U.S. The CIA declined comment. The Department of Energy referred us to the National Security Council. They declined comment, too. The Department of Defense and the U.S. Cyber Command sent us to the Department of Homeland Security, who referred us to the FBI. The FBI had no comment and sent us back to the Department of Homeland Security. But U.S. involvement in Stuxnet may have been cagily winked at, like when President Obama's representative on weapons of mass destruction spoke at a conference on Iran back in December.
I'm glad to hear they're having problems with their centrifuge machines, and I think that the U.S. and its allies are doing everything we can to try to make sure that that we complicate matters for them.
Symantec had to tackle Stuxnet because its business is to understand every computer virus in cyberspace. But even with Eric and his team of experts, the investigation spanned 8 long months and became all-consuming.
We'd go home and be looking at Stuxnet in our off times. You know, I sat in my bed with my laptop many, many nights over a very long period looking at Stuxnet.
So here's what he confronted. Approximately 15,000 lines of computer code. These strings of numbers and letters serve as instructions which tell a program what to do.
So from your perspective, I mean, how do you actually parse a computer virus?
You know, when we get a piece of malicious software, when we get code, we get literally zeros and ones. And we basically decode those. We look at the numbers and translate them into behaviors.
Do you know that it was targeting Iran by looking at the code itself?
We discovered it was targeting very specific equipment. But we didn't really, for example, identify that it was a uranium enrichment facility until 4 months after we had first seen Stuxnet.
And while it became clear that Stuxnet was focused on that one plant in Natanz, Iran, how it got there was still shrouded in mystery.
You may be able to trace it back to what an epidemiologist would call it patient zero. Where did the infection start? But you don't know how that person got infected.
Stephen Belevin at Columbia School of Engineering has seen more than his share of viruses. He's been tracking cybercrime for decades.
It did not attack its target over the internet. It was probably carried in by one of these flash drives.
That's a portable hard drive, sometimes called a USB key or flash drive. The dominant theory is that Stuxnet started on drives like these. Spies on the ground planted them in key areas, maybe even spots like a parking lot. Places where people who worked at Natanz or people who worked with people who worked at Natanz might find them.
Someone picks it up and says, oh, cool, I have a new flash drive, let me use it. When you do that with a Stuxnet one, it affects your computer.
So let's take a closer look at how the virus actually works. For our purposes, let's picture Stuxnet as a kind of super saboteur. He starts on a USB drive. It's big for a virus, but still a file so tiny that it's smaller than even one of your family photos or MP3s.
And as soon as he's plugged into any computer, he actually makes a copy of himself. He jumps off the key onto that computer. So you literally plug in a USB key for a couple of seconds, unplug it, and now that computer is infected.
He gets into any Windows operating system, just like the one that's probably running on your computer now. And he enters undetected. You wouldn't even know that Stuxnet had jumped into your machine because he sneaks in using something called a digital signature.
Imagine an ID card with your picture on it and your name. And using this ID card, the code can say, I came from Microsoft, and I haven't been tampered with, and you can trust I'm from Microsoft. But what Stuxnet did was it stole some of those identity certificates from two different companies and basically signed its own software with those certificates. So when that software came onto the computer, Windows said, oh, this looks legitimate. You come from a trusted vendor, and allowed Stuxnet to run.
Now, once Stuxnet is loaded into a computer, it starts looking for ways to spread, ways out. Let's call them doors.
It can spread in one of several different ways. It can look for other flash drives. It can spread to your file server. It can spread to a print spooler if you're sharing a printer with other people.
So Stuxnet can get around pretty well that way, but don't worry. He's not interested in breaking home computers.
It's a carrier. Think Typhoid Mary. She carried the typhoid germ. She wasn't sick from it. That's what your home computer would be like. It wouldn't slow it down. It might try to infect other computers, but it's not going to do any damage to your computer.
Remember, the only computer Stuxnet's really interested in breaking is that one in Natanz.
He's basically looking for something very particular. It's basically a mini computer that's running factory automation.
Stuxnet checks door after door, looking for that one specific computer that's so vital for the plant's operation.
And this is the exact same model that would have been running in the facility that Stuxnet targeted.
But this thing is smaller than a toaster.
Yeah, I was actually surprised when I got it. I had never seen it.
Believe it or not, you can just buy one online, which Chen and his team did when they were trying to get to the bottom of Stuxnet. It may not look like much, but this little module actually controls those centrifuges that are spinning up nuclear fuel. And when Stuxnet finally finds it, it begins unleashing destruction. Now, the centrifuges are already spinning near the speed of sound, but Stuxnet starts turning them even faster.
Well, you're spinning the centrifuge twice as fast as it's supposed to go. Just think of the tack on your car with that nice red line saying you're not supposed to run the motor more than 6,000 RPM, or you'll damage your motor.
And that's how Stuxnet destroys the centrifuges, essentially wrecking those very delicate, very expensive pieces of equipment. Isn't it one of the major jobs of a enrichment facility to be monitoring for centrifuges spinning out of control?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's multiple safeguards. But Stuxnet gets around those. Stuxnet's pretty smart.
It gave a fake readout to say, it's running at the normal speed, boss. It's not doing anything it's not supposed to. You've programmed it to do something, it's doing it, and you can look at your screen and see it's doing it correctly. And unknown to you, the motor is spinning twice as fast and damaging your centrifuge.
So Stuxnet tricks the computer into thinking that everything is just fine. But people work at those plants too. People with eyes and ears.
The noise alone would be very abnormal, be extremely loud. And there'd be someone in the control room who would literally hear something going wrong. And they have a big red button, literally, to shut down the system. And Stuxnet would hijack that.
This is just the beginning. I'm going to continue tomorrow to give you part two. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.